Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Julia LaRoche Show. I am pleased to bring to you this conversation with Alfonso Pecatiello. You know him as Macro Alf on Twitter and X, and he is the founder of The Macro Compass. In this episode, we do a deep dive into the macro picture. Alf explains that there's this pervading narrative out there that it looks a lot like 1995 and that we could see that soft landing and that equity markets will continue that momentum and the economy is resilient. However, this is a narrative that Alf does not buy. So we start to look into the recessionary risk out there, and he explains why it could actually come from outside the US first, specifically coming from China with the deleveraging spilling over into a number of different economies and how we could see those ripple effects. I really enjoyed this conversation with Alf. I learned a lot from him, and I hope you do too. Alfonso Pecatiello, founder of The Macro Compass. It is so great to welcome you to the show, Alf. I am so pleased to bring you on today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Julia, such a pleasure. We tried to arrange this for a bit. Finally, we are here. So you have the pleasure to listen to my Italian accent for half an hour.
Oh, great. I love it. And I think I pronounced your name correctly. So I'm really excited about that. And Alf, I've followed you on Twitter for a long time. You have a great Twitter presence. You're Macro Alf for the folks watching and listening. And let's kick things off, Alf, with the big picture, the macro view for you today, that framework that you're looking at the world at. And one of the things about the show, Alf, is take all the time you need to set the table, if you will.
All right, great. So what I will say is that party like 1995 is where investors are right now. So that's how it feels out there. And 1995, for reference, was a cycle where the Federal Reserve had raised interest rates in 1994. And then at some point, they had decided to take a pause, right? Which sounds very familiar. And then they had lowered interest rates. And walking into that shallow cutting cycle, the market was expecting the Fed to do quite some cuts, right? And then slowly but surely, they adjusted to the reality that the Fed only ended up cutting three times. So the Fed raised interest rates, then inflation slowed down. So they decided to cut interest rates, Julia, but they only did three cuts. That's it. And then they stopped the cutting cycle short and they never cut rates anymore for years and years to come, effectively, until we go back to the 98 and 2000 cycle. I think investors now are adjusting to the fact that this might happen again. So if you see, for example, the bond market was pricing seven cuts by the Federal Reserve just in December, so like less than 2 months ago. And data continues to come in relatively resilient. And so they're adjusting their expectations. It's not going to be seven cuts this year. It's going to be three cuts. And then in 2025, there are additional three to four cuts priced, but slowly but surely, the market is also trying to remove those. At the same time, despite the bond market acting a bit more hawkish, especially the short end of the curve selling off in the result, basically, of these cuts being priced away, the equity market doesn't want to hear it. It's one straight lineup, mostly driven by a few stocks. So the breadth of this rally is not very, very large, a bit like 1995 as well, where large cap stocks, so the biggest contributors to the index, were the one driving the gains. Right? That's exactly what's happening. We're seeing Nvidia now, I think today, reaching a valuation larger than the GDP of Canada or something along these lines. And so we are seeing the equity market basically ignore rising bond yields. And the reason is that something has changed. Apparently, according to the narrative, this time is different. And therefore, the US economy is structurally stronger. It can hold interest rates above 4 to 5% for a prolonged period of time, without incurring in any negative economic momentum. And so equity markets can continue to rise, even if bond markets are now being priced more hawkish. Again, this is not my opinion. I'm just summarizing what markets' prevailing narrative are out there today. What about investing in this environment? I think it's quite interesting that today, if I look at my monitor and the option implied probabilities of a recession that I can derive from bond markets, they have collapsed to 10%. So the bond market today thinks that a recession in the United States has to be priced at only a 10% probability for the next 12 months. Now, a recession happens, you know, once every 10 years on average over the last few decades. So 10% for the next year is pretty much a normal probability. Like, we're pricing the probability of a recession as if we are in a normal cycle. But the reality is the Fed has raised interest rates for a very long period of time. Conditions are tight. Interest rates are high. Mortgage costs are high. Borrowing costs for corporates are high. And they have been high for a while. So that is, I think, the dichotomy where the market has been swinging like a pendulum between, oh, the recession is going to happen tomorrow, to, oh, this is 1995, and whatever the level of yields, stocks will rally forever. And I think now we're going to the extreme euphoria part of the cycle.
Whoa, okay. So, so many different areas I want to explore with you. You were mentioning that there's this kind of narrative out there that it's like 1995, which I assume that that was a soft landing of sorts, or I guess that was a soft landing, right? 95?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And that a lot of folks are saying this time is different. The economy is structurally stronger. You can hold those rates above 4 to 5. The equity market's momentum can continue. I take it, Alf, that you might not buy into that narrative. Do you have a contrarian narrative to that existing one?
Yes. My contrarian narrative is that the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates from 0 to 5.25%. They have kept interest rates above 5% for already 3 quarters. They plan to keep interest rates above 5% for probably another quarter to come. So yes, monetary policy has been tightened. It is tight. Mortgage rates are high. The housing market is frozen. Corporates are finding it harder to borrow. And the longer you go without fresh credit, the longer you go without fresh debt into the economy at cheap interest rates, the tougher it is. So the narrative I want to confront the prevailing narrative with is that interest rates are cooling the economy, but of course it takes time until you can see the full results of this tightening cycle. And I think we live in an era where we are used to get these dopamine injections by scrolling on the phone and getting immediate information whenever we want it. And so people are trying maybe to apply the same idea to monetary policy, but it doesn't work that way. Monetary policy takes a lot of time to feed into conditions. And this time in the United States, it takes longer than usual. And why? Well, because U.S. households have been very smart, and U.S. corporates too. They have locked in low interest rates for a long period of time when interest rates were quite low. So before the pandemic and in 2021, both corporates and households have locked in long-term borrowing rates at very low levels. That means, Julia, that even if you raise interest rates today, as long as a corporate has locked in their funding for the next 10 to 15 years, they couldn't care less if interest rates are 3, 4, 5, or 6% today, right? Because they don't need to borrow. And the same goes for mortgages. So that basically delays the time, or basically delays the effect of the tightening monetary policy, because it takes longer until corporates and households have to refinance at these higher rates. If you see economies that instead don't have this protection, for example, you can think of Sweden or New Zealand, for instance. And why do I mention them is that most of their mortgage markets are based on floating rates. That literally means that if the domestic, the Central Bank of Sweden or New Zealand are raising rates, and they are following the Fed, the costs are immediately passed through households through floating mortgage rates. Man. So you can't wait. It's not like, ah, I locked in a 3% mortgage rate. No, no, no. You are facing today higher interest rates immediately, which means part of your salary has to go into servicing your debt rather than into spending. And so GDP in Sweden is 0%, and GDP in New Zealand is also roughly 0%. In the UK, same story. In Europe, same story. So not all economies are the same. The structure of the US economy has allowed the US so far to be more insulated from the tightening. But that doesn't mean it's always going to be the case. That only means it takes a lot longer. And I think late in the cycle, people always confuse the thing of a long cycle with something that has structurally changed. And so you start hearing that this time is different. And that is generally a dangerous assumption in finance to make.
That's okay. It'll take longer. So far we haven't seen it, but doesn't mean we won't see it. So my other follow-on to you, Alf, is when you look at the data, it does seem like really ambiguous, like looking at the data. So are there any signals or anything that you're looking at that maybe is starting to flash any sort of warning signs or things that you're particularly paying attention to?
Yeah, I would say that some parts of the economy, Julia, have already taken quite a hit. So you can see, for example, the activity in the housing market has slowed down pretty dramatically from 2020, 2021. So it's hard to say that that part is running very hot. It's hard to say that the very cyclical parts of the economy are doing particularly well. If you look at my gauge for cyclical industries employment in the United States, the full-time hiring from the cyclical industries, so namely transportation, manufacturing, construction, these type of industries that are very cyclical, well, the hiring pace is very, very low. Actually, the full-time hiring is completely flat. So they aren't firing people actively, but they aren't hiring either, which is not a symptom of cyclical parts of the economy doing particularly well. On the other side, though, the US economy is really bifurcated today. You're right, it's very ambiguous because consumer spending, for example, or retail sales have held up pretty well overall, right? So you have the consumer that is doing pretty well, or the more acyclical part of the economy that is still handling pretty okay, vis-a-vis the cyclical parts of the economy that are slowing. And so you got to wonder now, how long does it take until the overall economy slows down, taking more into account the tightening of financial conditions that has happened? And I think, again, you can look at history. It's always a good guide, right? The longest cycle we have had between the Federal Reserve raising rates and the labor market weakening in line with recessionary conditions is 2008. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates very aggressively up until July 2006. In July 2006, the Fed took a long pause of basically a year and a half. In 2007, especially in the first half, we were talking about a soft landing. Why? Because inflation has calmed down, employment growth was fine, GDP growth was fine, the Fed had raised rates to over 5%, kept it there for quarters. Sounds very familiar, right? So far. And it seemed like everything was great. If you remember the stock market in 2007, it went amazing, even though yields were very high. But then all of a sudden we realized 6 months later that it wasn't different. It was just that the lags were very long. And in that case, the housing market and the leverage that was built under the hood caused a great financial crisis. Now, of course, I'm not calling for a new great financial crisis, but I'm just bringing the example that the cycle can be very long. And you have to assume there is a possibility that today it looks like a soft landing. It looks like 1995, but the reality is that we're just waiting for the lags of the tightening from the Federal Reserve to finally kick in. Where does it show up? The answer might surprise you. I would say outside the US first. So everybody looks at the US and says, so where is it? Commercial real estate? Is it some banks? Is it the real estate market? I think the answer is more likely it's outside the United States. And we are looking at China. It's the second largest economy of the world. These guys are deleveraging, literally. So they are, Chinese property developers are in trouble. Xi Jinping has decided to try and move away the economic model of China from relying on their paper wealth generated by higher house prices into a more structurally sound model where the Chinese consumption goes up. So what he did is he decided to take some steam off the bubble, basically, in Chinese housing markets, but that has caused a deleveraging. So basically, you had this very highly leveraged market, and now property developers are under trouble, and households with mortgages are seeing their property prices move lower. And so what they do is, well, they try to pay off their debts as fast as they can. And as they do, they sell assets and asset prices move down further. And that's a vicious circle, also called balance sheet recession. So we're watching China doing this for now a long time. And I think we need to reflect over the spillovers that this can have in other economies. What are the economies the most tightly linked to China? I think that's a valid question.
Do you want me to answer?
You can give it a try. I can give you my opinion.
I want to hear, I have a possible idea, but I don't know. You go first.
Okay. So if you look at the financial spillover, they're very limited because China has capital controls. Most investors in Europe and in the US, they don't own a lot of Chinese assets. So it's hard for that to act as a direct weakness link, right? So you should look a little bit further and you should say, what are the economies that are the most linked to China? What are the economies that depend the most from Chinese demand? And then you go and have a look at the partners and the trade partners. So why don't we do it together? Because I have it in front of me here on the screen. And then if you look at them, you will see names like South Korea, Germany, Australia, Brazil, Mexico. You find this type of names, okay? And then you would also say, okay, what are countries where China has a direct type of investment relationship? And that's Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. Okay, those are the three countries. So I mentioned quite some of them out there, right? And all of a sudden, the US isn't top of the list anymore. And one needs to reflect on all these countries. And when I think about them, I see some of these countries that have raised interest rates in line with the Federal Reserve. So I look at Canada, I look at New Zealand, I look at the UK, for example. They've raised interest rates aggressively, but their economies are not structured very well to withhold such high interest rates, also because their mortgages perhaps are floating based, or they have a lot of debt coming due that must be refinanced at these higher rates. And that begs the question, are we overlooking the fact that maybe the Canadian economy or the Australian economy, or maybe the Brazilian economy might actually be the weakest links out there, and therefore they might experience the spillovers from China, and then all of a sudden it spreads also to the US and also to Europe because, yeah, Canada, Australia, Brazil, they're all more open economies. There are direct links as well for the US and for Europe. So it's a spillover that not many people are paying attention to, but you can't ignore the second largest economy in the world going through a deleveraging process. It will have ripple effects somewhere, most likely not directly in the US, but somewhere else can be systematically important enough for global economies to suffer as a result.
Hey there, I hope that you are enjoying listening to this episode. If you can, please take a moment to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you could leave us a rating and a review, it would help us so much in continuing to grow the show and bringing some incredible guests for these longer form discussions. Thank you so much for your support, and I hope you enjoy the rest of this episode.
That makes sense. I was going to say Australia was going to be my one of my guesses. So interesting. Yeah. Ripple effects of the deleveraging. Okay. Would you say then your base case is still that we are headed toward recession at some point?
Look,
I don't know.
The problem with it is, so the answer is yes. But the problem is obviously that as an investor, it's not enough. It's not enough to say, I think we're headed towards a recession, because you need to be pretty clear, precise, and timely. Otherwise, that's a very expensive view to own, right? Because maybe you will be right ultimately, but if it took 3 years for you to be right, then you were wrong, basically.
Yeah.
Or as my mentor used to say, in macro, as an investor, being early is akin to be wrong, or being too early means you probably were wrong. Because the time are too stretched for you to benefit from your view in the meantime, right? Or as someone else will say, we have a neighbor tracking error problem. And I'm like, what's the neighbor tracking error? Well, it's your neighbor being richer and buying media stocks and going and seeing them go to the moon while you for 1 year didn't have media. And so you're tracking your neighbor, you're tracking behind, you have a tracking error to your neighbor. And that's quite a psychological effect for investors, right? They want to have returns every month, every 3 months. Sometimes it takes longer for a view to play. I think there is also a discussion to be had, Julia, about the size and the potential depth of this recession, because the United States has repaired their private balance sheets after the great financial crisis. So what we have done there is that, well, the US private sector took quite a hit through the housing crisis that we had in the US in 2009 and 2010. And it has learned a lesson. The lesson is that over-leveraging your private balance sheet can be quite expensive when the deleveraging happens. And so what has happened is that the private sector in the US, after the great financial crisis, has been a bit more cautious in taking on leverage. We still do through credit cards, through mortgages, but it's more regulated, it's more cautious. Who has taken the baton of leveraging is the United States government. I mean, they're doing pretty well from that perspective. They're going ballistic in terms of deficits. But that is interesting because the private sector is the most vulnerable to a recession. When you have a recession and you're very leveraged on your own balance sheet, then you have a problem and you have to react swiftly because, contrary to the government of the United States, you cannot print money. if you are deleveraging and you have a recession, then you can't print money out of it. You have to find ways to basically deleverage your balance sheet. The government instead can always try to print money to keep the ball going effectively, as long as there is trust in the currency they're issuing, in the debt they're issuing, right? The United States issues the global reserve currency of the world. So it's an exorbitant privilege, which makes the US generally, be relatively in a relatively friendly setup when issuing new debt, when trying to print new money effectively to sustain the economy. And so what we're looking at today is a private sector in the US, which is a bit more robust. The US government is taking on the baton of issuing debt. And we are at a point where we used to have deficits back in the days to fight a rise in unemployment. If the economy was slowing, you would do more deficits to try and sustain economic growth. If the economy was accelerating, well, you would slow the deficits, right? It makes sense. Well, right now we're not doing that anymore. We're just doing deficits after deficits after deficits. It doesn't matter who's the president, really. It's not a political statement here. It's literally a weapon that US politicians are using to try and never have a recession, to always have a great cycle. And I think investors should reflect on the risks of that, because if you use deficits not anti-cyclically, not as a repair mechanism, but you use deficits permanently, that can be a source of volatility, I think.
Yeah, it seems like at some point that could put us in a real situation.
I would say so. So what is the risk here? If we have a look at what happened with the UK in October 2022, so let's walk back a year and a half. The UK was having high inflation back then, I think 7 or 8% already. And then the government of Liz Truss decided to go with an expansionary budget on top. So what they said is, we're going to do fiscal deficits on top of an inflation at 8%. Well, let's say that the bond market and the currency market didn't really take that well, because effectively you could see a combination of bond yields going up rapidly in the UK and the sterling depreciating at the same time. That combination is the signal often that bond vigilantes are back. So they don't like what's going on. They don't trust anymore the government to honor their obligations. And also that the currency vigilantes, let's say, are in action. So what's happening is that both the currency investors and the bond investors, Julia, they are demanding a premium to own your assets. They're saying, well, you are out of control. Inflation is 8%. You're issuing more debt on top, more fiscal on top. So if you want us to buy your bonds, if you want us to buy your assets in general, we're going to demand a premium. And at some point, that becomes unsustainable. And so what happened in the UK is that, well, Liz Truss had to resign. And the new prime minister had to come in with a much more contained budget and much more conservative fiscal stance in order to calm down markets. Where are we in the United States in this process? It hasn't happened, because yes, bond yields have temporarily gone higher sometimes, even at the long end. And some people put up a narrative that, oh, it's because the deficits, but the dollar was stronger, not weaker. So when you see a weaker dollar and higher yields at the long end, that's the point where investors say, I had enough. I'm going to demand a premium to own US assets. And that hasn't happened yet. And the main reason is, what do you own instead? The main question out there, if you remain in the mainstream asset classes, okay? The main question is, what are you going to own as your safe asset, if not US assets? I always ask this question, and it's a valid one, because you can say gold or Bitcoin if you're a private investor, and I understand your point of view, that if you are a large institution, you have trillions to invest, billions or trillions, therefore you must also have assets that sit in the mainstream asset classes. So those are bonds, those are equities. So what are you going to own? If you don't own US treasuries, what is next? And then you look around and you say, am I going to be owning Japanese bonds? Well, what Japanese bonds? They're mostly owned by the Bank of Japan. You can't even buy them if you wanted to. The liquidity isn't there. So what are you going to own instead? Chinese bonds? They have capital controls. They can easily lock you up there and you can never get up your money from China. What are you going to own otherwise? European bonds? I mean, we in Europe can barely even produce a joint fiscal stance. We still don't have a joint fiscal program, really. We have one central bank and 19 different fiscal decision-making countries. It's a very fragmented structure. So I could go on and on, basically to say that the US is the cleanest dirty sheet out there. And that's what it is in the mainstream financial system.
Yeah. Well, speaking of what to own, when you look at your own framework, how do you think about portfolio construction or asset allocation? And I don't know like what you could share there, but maybe things that could be interesting.
Yeah, I would say that one of the mistakes I see the most often in clients or in portfolios that are handled by private investors is that there is a very high correlation between their investment portfolio and their jobs. I find that very scary. So you have people that have something like, I don't know, a 60-40 portfolio, for example, and they tell me, well, Alf, my financial advisor told me that's great because it's diversified. And then when you run a risk analysis on this, you realize that 85% of the volatility of a 60-40 portfolio, 85% of it comes from stocks. Okay, stocks. Stocks are great in the long run, if bought at decent valuations, that is. But stocks also suffer strong period of drawdowns. I mean, in the 2008-2009 crisis, the 60-40 portfolio was down 36%. That's more of a third of your money disappearing in a very short period of time. And then I wonder, okay, if all the volatility is explained by stocks, when do stocks go down? And when they do go down, is your job safer or is your job more at risk? Well, when they do go down very rapidly, I would argue that your job is more at risk because the economy is not doing well, because something is happening that is scaring markets and scaring your employer probably. And then you have your job and your portfolio, which are highly correlated. That's a very scary proposition, right? So instead, I think what investors should look at is to construct an investment portfolio that protects their purchasing power, so tries to keep up with inflation, possibly a bit above that, that helps. But importantly, does so in an uncorrelated way to their jobs, in an uncorrelated way to how the economy is doing, how the stock market is doing. That's the true power of diversification, because then your purchasing power is protected and diversified against your job. And how do you do something like that? Not with the 60-40 portfolio. That's the short answer. The longer answer is you add other assets with the right weight to your portfolio, and these assets should benefit from periods where stocks and bonds don't necessarily do well. So what are these assets? Some of them, commodities, gold, emerging market exposure, because maybe the next leg in growth is not in the US, it's somewhere in emerging markets. Gold, commodities, a little bit of Bitcoin as well can help in certain cases. Emerging market exposure can help. Think broadly, try to construct a truly diversified portfolio that doesn't go down together with your job, basically, because all of a sudden you need your savings in that case, and you want to have them available, not 40%, not with a 40% haircut.
Yeah. Well, Alf, I have to say, I've really enjoyed having you on and listening to you and learning from you. I want to give you the final few minutes here to share more about, you know, your background, your work, how folks can learn more about what you're up to, and any parting thoughts, anything that we didn't bring up in this discussion that you'd like to leave with the audience, the floor is yours.
Yep. Thanks, Julia. So in my previous life, I ran a $20 billion portfolio for a large European bank. And I did that for 8 to 9 years. It was great experience, learned a ton, opened the doors to, you know, many investment banks, many hedge funds, a lot of knowledge. But it was an ivory tower sort of thing. You know, I was not allowed to talk to anyone out there publicly, let alone social media, because you work for a large institution and you run a lot of money. I decided that that was enough. And therefore, I wanted to try and do my own thing and share a bit of the knowledge and my process with people. So I started the Macro Compass, which is my firm. And I went on Twitter and everybody now knows me as Macro Alf. And, you know, I post sometimes pizza pictures and, you know, I'm this kind of guy, tries to share knowledge and learn along the way. I know I can make mistakes and I'm very happy to recognize those. Now, the Macro Compass is running. The next project that is already ongoing is that because of the macro volatility we discussed here and all these opportunities we just discussed all around the world, investors have asked me over the last year whether I would be open to run a macro fund again. And well, the answer is yes, because I see plenty of opportunities out there. And I think macro strategies can be exactly the type of uncorrelated strategies you might need as an addition in your portfolio. So I'm going to be running those and I'm going to be opening a macro fund. So all I can say is if anyone who has listened to this interview might have an interest in discussing this macro fund with me, then I'm an approachable person. Just go on Twitter at MacroAlf, send me a message. We can talk about it, or send an email at fund@themacrocompass.com.
Well, Alfonso Pecatiello, founder of The Macro Compass, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and all of your ideas. Really appreciate you taking the time, Alf, to join me today.
Thanks, Julia. Been a pleasure.